What are you reading now? And what have you read in the past? How do the things you've read in the past help you better understand what you're reading today? Or in the future for that matter? And what if it wasn't just what you read, but what you listened to or watched? And hey, what if this could be shared with lots of folks? Welcome to That Reminds Me.
This is episode 1H, featuring a conversation between Ashish Kulkarni and Adish Khanna, recorded on 31st March 2020. Ashish had spent February reading about Germany and blogging about what he had read or watched. Adish and Ashish spoke about the creation of modern Germany, World War I, hyperinflation, and the lessons of German reunification. This discussion frequently digressed into other topics, including dollarization, the Indian experience of demonetization, and how species evolve.
Ashish, how you been doing in this time of strife?
Not bad at all, actually, except for the fact that I'm locked up at home and can't visit restaurants, which is, I've just begun to realize, a thing I was positively addicted to. Everything else is not too bad.
That's true for me as well. So let's get started on our podcast soon. But before we do, let's just tell the listeners that we're doing something different today. I'm going to be asking you about things you've read and watched instead of the other way around.
Yep. And the shoes of the other foot, the tables have turned, and I can't think of a third way to phrase it.
And along with the tables being turned, we are also going to be doing something a little bit different, because while you generally ask me about specific episodes I've listened to or specific books I've read, I'm going to be talking to you about a larger theme in which you've read multiple different things. So it remains to be seen what we're going to get reminded of during the course of the conversation. But yep, that's the exciting part. So let's get to it. And we are going to talk about a country you've been studying and writing about on your blog throughout February, which is Germany, a country that we are both very fond of, and a country that also has a very rich history as well as a very rich present, which provides lots of opportunities of things to talk about. But if you don't mind, how I'd like to go about it is talk to you first about the creation of Germany. And our listeners may or may not know that the creation of Germany itself was quite an involved process. We are then going to talk about German hyperinflation between the two world wars and the circumstances surrounding it and what it led to. And in the end, we're going to talk about something you devoted a lot of attention to, which is German reunification in 1989 and beyond.
Absolutely. Look forward to it. Let's get started.
Since we're going to finish with German reunification, let's get started with German unification. What can you tell our listeners about this?
So I don't know how many listeners are going to be aware of this, but Germany itself isn't actually all that old a political concept. It only came together in the sense that we understand it sometime in the 1870s. I don't remember the exact year now, but around that time. And of course, the person who seems to have been more responsible for German unification than anybody else was Otto von Bismarck. And the whole process of unification started in a period of, I'm not at all an expert on 19th century Europe, but it seems to have started in a period of almost never-ending strife. European powers seem to have been in and out of wars on an almost consistent, constant basis throughout the 19th century. And it's around the 1870s that there started a movement. I wouldn't call it necessarily a popular movement the way I understand it, but they started a movement to get German-speaking people together. And of course, apart from Otto von Bismarck, the other major involvement over here was of two things. One, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and second, of the royal family of, I'm never sure of the pronunciation, but I think Habsburg, is that correct?
Habsburg, I think, but close enough in an English context.
Okay, so those are the players that I think you need to think about when you start thinking about the process of German unification.
Yeah, and since you brought up the fact that this was a time of constant strife, and we're referring to the whole 19th century here, there were the Napoleonic Wars in the first half.
Yeah.
There was the Crimean War later on.
Yes.
But we should also let our listeners know that this was not just a time of wars between states. It was also a time of major revolutions inside states.
Yeah.
There had, of course, been the French Revolution in the previous century, but it was followed up by more French counter-revolutions and revolutions, as also revolutions and nationalist movements inside Italy and other areas that were under the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
Yep, absolutely. And the one thing that what you just brought up reminds me of is one of the best books that I've read about this period, the lead up to the First World War, was a book that I've referred to often on my blog. It's called The War That Ended Peace. And there were apparently also at that point of time in the lead up to the First World War, also a lot of pacifist movements that were going through Europe. So it really was, in a sense, reminiscent of the early parts of the 20th century. There was a lot of chaos, sure, but there also were increasingly strident calls for peace.
And we'll get to the war that ended peace in a bit, but at this point, I'd just like to give my own recommendation of a book to you and the listeners. This is a book called Germania by Simon Winder.
All right.
Who is a British author, and he seems to do for European history what Bill Bryson does for travel.
Wonderful.
Which is to just land up somewhere, wander around, get into all kinds of confusion, and at the end of it, produce a book about it, except it happens to be about history and not about travel.
Excellent. Would you mind repeating the name again, please?
Yeah, this is a book called Germania by Simon Winder.
Excellent. All right.
And it's a companion book to a book called Danubia, which is about the history of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, but really about the Habsburg family.
Excellent. All right. Made a note of it and I'll add it to the list.
With that recommendation out of the way, let's get back to the war that ended peace.
The war that ended peace was to me fascinating when I read it, and it really is time for a reread, I think. The thing that fascinated me the most was about how often war could have broken out before it actually and finally did. So most people, of course, know about the assassination of the Archduke, and that's how the First World War started. But Margaret Macmillan makes the point that at any point of time between the early 1890s up until 1914, war could have broken out. And the primary reason for war would have been the fact that Germany and Britain kept, in a sense, engaging in a bitter race, not so much an arms race, that was secondary, but in a race to quite literally conquer the world in an imperialist sense. So this is not something that I covered in detail on the blog, but one perhaps consequence, perhaps design behind German unification was to get a leg up on Britain, so to speak, and to catch up with what was by then the foremost leader in the European part of the world. And that, more than anything else, is what contributed to the start of the First World War.
And it's perhaps a bit of a digression, but it's interesting to consider that if you had gone just 100 years back in time, you would not have predicted that Britain would be the leading power in Europe.
For a variety of reasons, yes.
Even more so, you would not have predicted that Germany would be in the top two.
Yeah. In fact, Germany, in the sense in which we understand it today, didn't even exist back then. So the point was moot.
Yeah. So if we can circle back around and see what exactly were the circumstances and the actions which led to the concept of Germany emerging.
So one was friction with neighboring countries more than anything else. It was, in a sense, made necessary because of a series of pacts that were being signed all over Europe. And really, the story begins to heat up for us. I'm using the First World War as a reference, but the need for unification was made even more concrete through, I forget the word for it, it'll come back to me in a minute, the Triple Alliance. This was between, if I remember correctly, the newly formed German nation, Italy, and I think the what was back then the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And that, in a sense, resulted in a sort of almost central European alliance, if you will, which is where things really start to heat up in Europe. So as a consequence of this alliance, other countries felt it necessary to overcome old differences, most notably, say, for example, between France and England. Russia has a role to play, but slowly but surely you start to see powers aligning themselves actually against each other, but the fig leaf was aligning with certain nations.
Yeah, so I'm sorry to break your flow, but I'd just like to bring in something which Simon Winder's books did point out, which is that for years, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was the, and not just years, for centuries, the Austro-Hungarian Empire was Europe's defense against the Ottoman Empire. But at the same time, it never really had a warm water navy or any navy at all. It spent years trying to get a little bit of Italy and the port called Trieste. And alliance between Germany, Italy, and Austro-Hungary was not just worrisome for the other powers. You mentioned Russia, Britain, in terms that it now was occupying a lot more area because it had always occupied a lot of area. Mm-hmm. But because it could now have a navy, which previously it did not have.
Absolutely. And a name that this reminded me of, which I had forgotten about entirely, so thank you for dredging it up from my memory banks, a guy called Admiral Alfred von Tirpitz, who more than anybody else was responsible for making sure that the German navy was at least as good as it was at the start of the First World War.
A slight digression to my digression, but we'll get back to von Tirpitz in a bit.
Yep.
Anyone who's seen the Sound of Music would know that Captain von Trapp is a naval captain, but that Austria is a landlocked country.
Yep.
And the contradiction or the inconsistency is resolved once you know that Austria-Hungary had made these great efforts to have a port at Trieste.
Yep. And three other things that this reminds me of. So we are digressing upon a digression, which was already a digression upon a digression. Rather beginning to feel like Alice in Wonderland right now. But I'm sure we'll circle back to what was our original point. But before I forget, Dan Carlin has a series of podcasts on the First World War, which I found very informative, if a little long drawn, one. And second, Adish, maybe you will remember the name of the book. I want to not cheat and use Google right now. But I think it was The Guns of August or something like that. Barbara Tuchman, I think, was the name of the author.
I'm sorry, I haven't. World War One is not a major interest of mine.
Then it is The Guns of August, correct, by Barbara W. I don't know if I'm pronouncing this correctly, but Tuchman or Tuchman, one of the two.
Okay.
But all right, back to the original point. So can you help us circle back to what we were originally speaking about?
Yeah, we were talking about German reunification, but we hadn't quite done with von Tirpitz.
Okay, all right. So von Tirpitz before, he was a guy, like I said, who was most responsible for the start and the almost insistence by him that Germany develop a strong navy, because without which it simply would not be possible to go up against Britain at a worldwide level, one. And second, the thing that I found the most surprising while reading that book, this was entirely unexpected to me as a student of international trade, but as it turns out, Germany's biggest trading partner in the lead up to the First World War was in fact Great Britain and vice versa, which to me was entirely unexpected.
But I think this is going to be us quoting different bits of the war that ended peace and Germania to each other,
okay,
which is not necessarily a bad thing. But again, this at the time you're talking about, the British royal family was largely related German.
Yes, absolutely.
The fact that the United Kingdom had to go into war with Germany after about two decades of largely congenial relations caused a great deal of a cultural U-turn, you might say.
Yes, and absolutely. In both royal families, in Germany as well as in England.
Exactly.
like you said, it might end up being we quoting to each other from the two books that we both seem to like so much, but I can imagine worse things. But it really was, the reason it was surprising to me, I speak of the economic data now, is because I don't know if you've read Thomas Friedman's hypothesis, I think it's called the Big Mac hypothesis.
That two countries which both have McDonald's don't go to war with each other?
Yeah, absolutely. So, of course, the McDonald's thing is a sort of proxy for trade. But the point he's making is countries that trade with each other tend to not go to war with each other. And it was, to me, immensely surprising to find out that not only was the First World War a clear argument against Friedman's hypothesis, but such an exceedingly large one about Germany and England finally choosing to go to war.
I suppose this is also a question of how you sort and categorize trading partners, because if the trading partner is 10%, but you're comparing it to a bunch of 5%, 4%, and so on,
mm-hmm.
it that might not hold true. And I'd also be interested to know, is that considering the German Empire and the British Empire as a whole, or are we considering Great Britain's trading partners to be Germany, British India, British Africa, etc., etc.?
Interesting point. I don't know the details. I'll have to look it up. But I remember reading about this in the book. But you raise an interesting point. I don't know if it was the empires trading with each other or whether it was just the two countries.
Did it consider the goods and services and capital flowing between Great Britain and India to be internal or external?
Yeah, interesting point. I don't know the answer right now, but it's certainly worth looking up.
I think we are done with the tidbits, but unless you have more.
No, even reading the Wikipedia article about one tidbits will be worth your while, I would say. But really, the book has much more in terms of details. But we can go back to the original point now.
Of unification.
Yes. So I had mentioned this in the blog post, and I'll quote a little bit. At its birth, more than the area itself, what was interesting to me is Germany had a population of about 41 million, which grew to 67 million by 1914. And the reason this point is interesting, and the reason I'm going to enjoy having this conversation so much, is because there are a whole host of things that I wanted to speak about where both Germany and France were concerned, but was not able to in the blog post because of considerations of length. The 41 million to 67 million growth, one part may have been by acquisition, but this was interesting to me. There were also clarion calls made by leaders in not just both of these nations, but apparently through many countries in Europe, asking people to quite literally have more children. Having a younger, more growing population was seen as a very important thing in Europe at that point of time.
And it's seen as an important thing in quite a few countries in Europe and outside, both now and in the 20th century.
Yep, absolutely. And back then, for two reasons. One, because you could always make use of extra hands in terms of manufacturing output, but also for the sake of armies. So there literally were apparently posters put up in Europe asking families to do their duty and have more children. It's fascinating how thinking about demographics changes in such a short period of time.
Well, we have posters asking Indian Parsis to have more children in the present day.
True.
And I think if I can find it, we should put a link up to this fascinating article about how Iran changed its
yes.
approach to demographics almost within 15 years. And not only did they change their outlook, the actual birth rate also swung extremely dramatically within a 15 or 20 year period.
Yep, this is, I have a strong urge to be utterly juvenile and say same pinch right now, because that used to be the article that I quoted a lot in my classes on demographics and development. I think you're talking about an article called What Started the Biggest Population Boom in History.
I'm not sure if that's the title, but this was an article which I've read about 5 or 6 years ago and which has always stuck with me.
For very good reasons. One of my favorite articles. We'll be sure to link to it in the blog post. Absolutely.
I think you've mentioned this in your previous blog posts that Poland also has a pro-natalist policy.
Yes, absolutely.
In Europe at the current moment, as do Singapore and South Korea, which are also faced with below replacement fertility rates.
Japan and Italy also need to be counted. Italy now perhaps for other more sadder reasons, but quite a few countries are going through a period where they urge their population to, populate more, so to speak.
With varying rates of success.
With varying rates of success, absolutely. In fact, you keep traveling to Singapore, you more than anybody else will be able to speak about this.
Singapore is fascinating because it seems to be a country with a low birth rate, but with a wide variability in number of children. It seems that although officially birth rate is 1.4 or 1.6 in that range per woman,
yeah,
most people who are having children are having more than one, which leads you to suspect that a lot of people are not having children at all.
A bimodal distribution.
Yeah. Along with this, the one of the things not known very much about Singapore and which is both a major success as also a major something that will create its own problems down the line in other aspects is that the rate of interracial marriage in Singapore has been consistently growing for the last 30 or 40 years.
Okay. And, right. Sorry, please go ahead.
And why I say that this will create some level of problem down the line is that the education policy of Singapore calls for you to be educated in English as well as your mother tongue, but it makes no provision for the children of parents who have different mother tongues.
Huh, fascinating. All right, I want to circle back to speaking about, because you raised the point about Poland. One thing that surprised me a lot about Poland is apparently it is one of the few countries in the world that has a decreasing urbanization rate, which was to me fascinating. But I mentioned that only as an aside. Using Poland and circling back to the point of German nationalism, it was interesting to me to find out how exclusionary Bismarck's idea of Germany was, especially where the Polish Empire was, or the country of Poland, put it however you like, was concerned. I'm quoting now from something that he wrote in a letter to his sister: "Hammer the Poles until they despair of living. I have all the sympathy in the world for the situation, but if we want to exist, we have no choice but to wipe them out." So most people will be familiar with Hitler and Poland in the lead up to the Second World War, but apparently antagonism towards the Poles goes back much, much longer and obviously predates even Bismarck.
And when Bismarck was writing this, were the reasons racial, were the reasons geopolitical, or was it a combination?
Geopolitical. This was in the year 1861. Just later that year, in public, Bismarck then wrote to Prussia's foreign minister. The part that I quoted earlier was to his sister in a private correspondence. But effectively, he was saying that anything that helps a Polish national movement succeed is a defeat for Prussia. And he viewed it as a zero-sum game. For Prussia to succeed, Poland had to fail and vice versa.
And we should explain to our listeners that most of Prussia is what is now within the boundaries of current-day Poland.
Yep, absolutely. In fact, I know you're supposed to be asking me questions, but I want to cheat a little bit and ask you about a trip that I believe you had made to Poland and Germany some years ago.
Sure.
Could you speak a little bit about what obvious differences you saw, or whether there were, even when you made the trip, any lingering evidences of antagonism between the two peoples? Did that come across at all or not in the least?
It came across a little. Again, I'll elaborate a little bit about the trip. I wanted to see the prison where P.G. Woodhouse had been interned during World War II as a civilian prisoner of war.
One of my favorite quotes from Woodhouse.
And this is something that we'll probably speak about more when we get to German unification. But this is in a region called Silesia, which is called Schlesien in German.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time of World War II, this was territory of the German nation.
Yep.
As in, this had not been invaded by Hitler. It was already part of the German nation post-World War I. Because of that, when you wander around Silesia, you see a lot of evidence of its German past in right. terms of the 19th century architecture that still persists.
Mm-hmm.
But when you talk about lingering hostility or about memorialization, you see more memorials to the victims of communism and the communist regime than of either the Holocaust or of World War II or of German occupation.
Ah, okay.
And similarly, if you are just walking around, you see much more that is attributable to Poland's time behind the Iron Curtain than to Silesia's time as part of Germany.
Which is also a fascinating part of Germany's history.
Yeah.
All right. What next, Adish?
Right. So I think we are in danger of circling into digression after digression if we stick on with German unification. But so for the sake of moving the episode along and for the sake of talking about new things, let's get on with, not that we weren't going to talk about new things in all our digressions anyway, but let's move on to the experience of Germany with hyperinflation after the First World War.
Okay.
Which is something that you devoted a blog post to and gave multiple different links, all of which tie into other of your interests as an economic professor.
Yep.
So let's start with what is hyperinflation? What led Germany to go through it? And we'll develop on that afterwards.
All right. Hyperinflation, just to use non-technical terms, because I believe that's actually going to make it more accurate, is just a ridiculously sharp rise in the prices of, well, practically everything. And there are quite a few countries in the world where hyperinflation has taken place. Most people obviously know about Venezuela and Zimbabwe in a modern context. But while I was reading about Germany, one of the most surprising episodes of hyperinflation that I came across, which I'm slightly ashamed to say I hadn't known of earlier, was Hungary. But whether it is Hungary immediately after the Second World War, whether it is Venezuela, whether it is Zimbabwe, or as we're about to speak about now, Germany, hyperinflation is prices changing so rapidly and increasing so quickly that practically nothing is able to keep up with them, least of all incomes. And that leads to a whole host of, as you can imagine, problems, which is what Germany went through. Multiple stories about this. Two of my favorite anecdotes, I don't know if either of them are true or not. They may be apocryphal, but they're still worth the telling of the story. One was about how a wheelbarrow full of cash was stolen. The cash wasn't, but the wheelbarrow was. And the second one, I think, comes from Keynes, if I'm not mistaken, in which he speaks about how the froth on top of the beer takes longer to dissipate than does the price of the beer itself, or something along those lines.
As a point of curiosity,
yeah,
currencies which are associated with having a very low unit value and where banknotes start in the thousands or tens of thousands. So
yeah,
the old Italian lira, the yes, Indonesian rupiah, the new Taiwanese dollar, would yeah, it be fair to say that these are currencies of countries that have experienced hyperinflation at some point of time, or is it just some sort of artifact of something else?
I would feel safe in saying could be either, but it's all but inevitable that there will have been a period of, if not hyperinflation, at least a rapid rise in inflation in those countries. I'm trying to think of a counter example right now. I'm not very sure. I've never been to Japan, but would Japan qualify as a country where you have high denomination currency notes, but not necessarily very rapid inflation? I'm not sure.
I'm not familiar with Japanese currency either. So.
Yeah, in Indonesia, for sure, there have been periods of hyperinflation. I'm not familiar with Taiwanese macroeconomic history. So I'm not really sure, but could be because of one or the other. But it's an interesting question.
So I'm reading that Japan has 1,000 yen, 2,000 yen, 5,000 yen and 10,000 yen banknotes in circulation.
Right.
But coins come in 1 yen, 5 yen, 10 yen, 50 yen, 100 yen and 500 yen denominations.
Correct. So I'm aware that Japanese currency has very high denomination, but I'm not sure whether it is because of hyperinflation. I would tend to think not, at least for the last 30 to 40 years. I'm not sure before that.
Sure.
But all right, it's a question worth researching. So thank you for that.
Getting back to Germany, what brought about German hyperinflation? And for that matter, do we know what brings about hyperinflation anywhere? Or is it still an unsolved question?
The fact that hyperinflation keeps occurring with distressing regularity, at least in a decadal sense, would mean that we probably don't have a definitive answer about how to stop it. But it's easy enough to say that it is because of a combination of adverse supply shocks, either the same or rising demand, and the urge to solve the problem by printing obscene amounts of money. So in a sense, it's a perfect monetary storm that causes hyperinflation. And in a sense, that's kind of what happened after the First World War as well.
And the supply shock in that case would have been?
The First World War and the utter and complete destruction of the manufacturing capacity of Germany in terms of practically everything, but most notably consumer goods.
All right.
It was surprising how prosperous Germany was before the First World War and how quickly it came to be destroyed after. When I say destroyed, I mean the economy and the ability to produce. There's a fascinating, I don't remember the exact details of it, but so rapid was the destruction in Germany of the currency that I remember reading somewhere that an American had tipped some, maybe it was a dollar, maybe it was two, something like that. But some tip had been left in the currency of the dollar rather than of the German currency at that point of time. And there was a very serious meeting amongst the staff about what should be done with that dollar. And ultimately, I think they decided to set up a special bank account to keep that dollar in or something along those lines. But the amount or the extent to which the currency was destroyed is ridiculous. I think it touched 1 trillion marks to the dollar at some point of time. Let me dig up the article. To answer your original question, it was almost certainly the A, complete destruction of the ability to produce, and second, because of the amount of currency that had been printed. And another reason which monetary economists debate until this day, but was Germany's decision to abandon the gold backing at the start of the First World War.
Okay? You've also written that Germany managed to tame hyperinflation almost miraculously.
Mm-hmm.
And how did it do that?
How did Germany almost miraculously say what?
How did Germany almost miraculously end hyperinflation?
I'm still not sure about the answer myself, in the sense that whatever it is that I've read about and written about seems interesting, but I find it difficult to believe that that was the one reason that inflation ended as rapidly as it did. But the movement to another currency mattered. And in a sense, it was quite literally down to belief. So one of the most interesting things that I found out was that the root of the word credit comes from a Latin word called credere, which literally means to believe. So when you say incredulous, you really are referring to the same root as there is of credit. And so the abolishment of that old currency, which was so rapidly debased, and the establishment of a new one, more than anything else, contributed, as I understand it, to the ending of hyperinflation. So it literally was belief more than anything else.
And in whatever you've read about hyperinflation in other nations, either cured or still festering, did something similar happen, or is it again part of those unsolved mysteries?
Absolutely. So Brazil is another example of a country where an alternate currency was introduced. And if I remember correctly, there was a stage in Brazil's history where two currencies ran at the same time. The old one and the new one before the new one was established. Let me just look this up. I think the old currency, and knowing me, I'm probably getting the name wrong. The old currency was called the Cruzeiro, and it was only later on that it was replaced with the Real. And if I remember, like I said correctly, there was a point of time where both currencies ran together. And that, both in Brazil and in Germany, helped the period of hyperinflation to get over.
I don't know if it's relevant to mention here, and you can correct me if this is irrelevant, but if you've ever been to Cambodia to visit Angkor Wat, I don't know if this is something which is true for all of Cambodia or only of Siem Reap, which is a highly tourist and tourism driven city. But that is a city where the US dollar is the de facto currency.
Dollarization, I mean, I've not been to Cambodia, but I can imagine.
So it's not as though Cambodia does not have a currency of its own.
Yeah.
But it really does not bother to have a...
any faith or belief in its own currency.
Well, perhaps it does have faith or belief in its own currency, and there does seem to be some fluctuation of the Cambodian currency around the dollar price. So you do have parallel prices in the Cambodian currency, which I can't remember the name of right now, and the dollar. It's by and large stable at 20 to the dollar. But you, if you go to a money changer, you'll find some fluctuations around 20 at a money changer. But when you go to a shop or a restaurant, it's pretty much fixed at that 20 rate.
Okay. The reason I laughed right now is as you were talking about the Cambodian currency right now, I just ran a simple search for Cambodian currency, and Google tells me that it is a riel. Hopefully, I'm pronouncing it correctly.
And?
R-I-E-L. But this is the part that made me laugh. The riel is their national currency. However, USD is widely accepted and generally preferred. This often means you'll get your change in both USD and riel, which can be really confusing.
This is an experience that I've had personally.
Okay. Although we should make clear to our listeners, especially those who are tempted to try something like this in India, it is a crime to not accept the rupee in an Indian context. So while Cambodia may be forgiving of this, as I believe is Ecuador, in most countries in the world, a refusal to accept your own domestic currency is a crime punishable by law. And in this regard, before I forget, a quote by Henry Ford is also useful. I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but his quote runs along these lines. It is as well that the people of our country don't understand how the monetary system of our country works, for if they did, there would be riots in the morning. All right. So, like I said, hyperinflation ended in Germany literally because of the establishment of a new currency. I think it was called the Rentenmark or Rentemark or something along those lines. But that effectively is what ended it.
And again, just as a thought experiment before we move on from hyperinflation, you've talked about Brazil having two currencies at the same time. We've talked about the introduction of a new currency in Germany and in Brazil. We've talked about dollarization in Cambodia and Ecuador. And it's interesting to think of a situation where a currency experiences hyperinflation and it says, let's have a new currency and let's have dollars at the same time to act as a shock absorber.
In fact, I would say that the minute whether the government decrees it or not, if people start accepting or trading in a second currency, that usually is a death knell for the first original currency. The most convincing argument I have, forget all the economic details or the technical details, it simply is faith or belief in the purchasing power of whatever it is that you have in your wallet. The minute that belief is gone, the system crumbles.
It's interesting to compare that with the time of demonetization in India, where regardless of how well it was implemented or not, in theory, if you had 45 days to turn in your old 500 rupee notes and 1000 rupee notes,
yeah,
it should not have caused the panic of heading to the banks the very next day. And it's remarkable that people stopped accepting the 500 rupee notes in a widespread way almost immediately and did not think that this was something which they could deposit 44 days down the line.
If anything, I think it's credit to the Indian people for taking the decrease by the Indian government ever so seriously. It's not just that we believe in our currency, but the minute the government says stop believing in it, we almost immediately and without thinking about it, stop believing in it. So if anything, I take a sort of perverse pleasure in saying that we have, if anything, far too much faith in our currency and the government for the rules by which it sets the currency in stone.
Which is surprising because we generally do not take other things which our government says with that much faith.
True.
As we are finding to our peril with the quarantine violations.
Absolutely. I think we have set sociologists in our country some tasks for the days to come. Why is it that certain beliefs are so well entrenched while others are not at all?
That's a good note to end this diversion into hyperinflation on. We've not just discussed hyperinflation, we've come up with new problems for sociologists. So
imagine that.
Let's get to German reunification, and perhaps by the end of that, we'll have a problem for psychologists to solve.
We'll try.
So we are going to talk about reunification now. What I found fascinating from reading your blog posts and links about reunification is that you've referenced a number of different articles. Some are about the outcomes of reunification and how legal or theoretical reunification has not led to actual homogeneity, and we'll get to that in a bit. But what has been really fascinating to me in this whole thing is that the articles you've linked to and what you've talked about in the run-up to reunification mention so many different aspects. There's not just the sheer exuberance of the border being opened and the countries being reunited, but the entire geopolitical and legal in terms of international treaties, as well as economic work that went into it. So you've, I think, mentioned the challenges of combining the East German and the West German currencies. You've mentioned the treaties that went into it, as also the politics itself. So why don't you start with any of those, and we'll lead on from there.
Sure. One of the most surprising and informative things to me while researching this particular blog post was the 2+4 agreement, which I'd heard about briefly, but was not ever sure about the details. And in fact, didn't even know who the plus four were. Very quickly for our listeners, the 2+4 agreement essentially was between the two countries that were the two Germany, so East and West Germany. The plus four were the so-called occupying powers. So they were France, United Kingdom, USSR, and the United States of America. So effectively for Germany to be reunified, it was not just those two countries saying, East and West Germany saying that, all right, we'll now be one country. But also the four occupying powers had to renounce all rights that they had in Germany. And to use a phrase from the next generation, it sort of blew my mind to realize that 40 years down the line, you still needed permission from the four occupying powers, but you did. And it was therefore that the 2+4 agreement came to be. And that's how German reunification became possible at all.
I was familiar with the fact that in the aftermath of World War II, Germany had been split up into Soviet, French, British and American zones of control. But yeah. I had no realization that it had extended all the way up to 1989. In my head, this would have ended sometime in the 1950s or 1960s.
Exactly. Exactly. It's weird how, I mean, I would argue that both you and I would consider ourselves to be reasonably well-read. And I'm speaking for myself over here. I don't know about you, but I had absolutely no clue that you needed four other countries to accept reunification in the first place.
Yeah, but it's a logical thing to assume that as soon as a country is running its own elections and electing its own parliament and prime minister again, that it is no longer under occupation, but yes. Clearly not.
Absolutely. So yeah, that was the 2+4. And even if nothing else came out of writing that particular blog post, just the discovery of the 2+4 agreement itself was interesting. But it was not just the 2+4, as you mentioned in your original question, Adish, it was also the case that the economics of it had to be managed really, really carefully, because when you are trying to, how shall I put it, get two separate countries to be one country, and that means one currency, that means one administration, one fiscal policy, it becomes very, very difficult to think through all of this. In fact, in this regard, people who want to learn more about the economic theory behind this, I would recommend a paper written by a guy called Robert Mundell. This goes back to the year 1958. And knowing my memory, I'll probably butcher the name of the paper, but it's about optimum currency areas.
And so, are these geographical areas or theoretical areas?
Optimum currency areas, Bob Mundell was essentially asking a question which a lot of people have asked themselves. For example, I asked myself this question when I was an undergrad student. Why is there not one common currency for the entire planet? Or why do India, Pakistan and Bangladesh, for example, not have one currency? Or pick any group of countries that you want, why different currencies? So the theoretical work was laid out by Bob Mundell in 1958, in which he laid out a set of circumstances under which you can at least begin to envisage a common currency. But if those set of conditions are not met, then no, you just can't have a same currency. But in this case, in East and West Germany's case, even though the conditions may not have been met at the outset, political considerations were more important than economic considerations. And that was a challenge, that whether or not it made economic sense, it made political sense to unite in all senses, including economic ones.
What this reminds me of, weirdly, is India's time zones, where it makes sense for India to have two time zones, but political considerations meant that we have Indian Standard Time, which causes further awkwardness because there's a half hour offset from standard time zones, which are 1 hour offsets from GMT or Universal Time, as it's called.
Absolutely. And if any listeners are confused by this, the easiest way to help you understand this is by reminding you how quickly the sun seems to set in Kolkata during a test match. That's the best way to understand what Adish is speaking about right now.
I think there are a number of interesting articles about India's history of time zones. We'll try to pull one up and link it in the show notes. Along with one more digression before we come back to reunification, I'd just like to mention how this idea of an optimum currency area, and well, perhaps not that idea itself, but your undergrad question of why is there not one universal country for the world, or even why is there not one country for India, Pakistan and Bangladesh?
Not country, Adish, it was currency. Why not one common currency?
I'm sorry, one currency.
Yeah.
So, which is a question that goes in sharp opposition to Jane Jacobs's recommendation that each city should have a different currency.
Yeah, and at one point of time, there were multiple currencies, for example, in the United States of America as well. So there's some sort of historical backing for Jane Jacobs' point. But it was only with the establishment of the Federal Reserve that you had one common currency. But people would be surprised at how often it was the case that banks were able to issue their own separate currencies.
And as I said, I don't know if the paper you mentioned by Mandal is in opposition to Jane Jacobs's proposal or is supporting it.
It doesn't get into that point at all, but it does establish conditions under which you can envisage having one common currency area. By the way, apart from Mandel's paper, you might also want to read a essay written by Paul Krugman on the issue. If you just search for Revenge of the Optimum Currency Area, you should get the essay by Krugman. That's much easier to read than the academic paper that I just mentioned.
Okay.
But both the Krugman paper or the Krugman essay or the Mandel paper don't get to the issue of local currency areas. But it, like I said, just establishes conditions under which you can imagine having one currency over an entire area. But yeah, local currency systems are a very popular concept. If I can just go into one minor digression, if you go into, say, for example, a shop called Newton's in Goa, when they don't have change, they will issue you local tokens, which are then can be treated as currency, not just in the Newton shop, but in certain shops in that area in Kalangut, Goa. So local currency systems are a whole separate issue. Sorry, go ahead.
Before we get back, let's just leave it at theoretically, an optimum currency area could be a very local area or a city region, as Jane Jacobs called it.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so let's come back to the reunification now. We've talked about the lead up to reunification. What about the aftermath?
Endlessly fascinating. So I, if I remember correctly, I just posted a couple of articles about the aftermath. But the two things that mattered to me is, and I remember writing about this, so let me quote from the blog post that I have put up. One way of thinking about reunification is West Germany purchased access to culture by sharing economic prosperity, while East Germany purchased access to economic prosperity by sharing culture. And the reason I said this is because I had shared one article in that blog post, which speaks about how Germany seems to have been a case of East Germans being much more culturally active than was West Germany. I've unfortunately not traveled through Germany enough to get a sense of this. And maybe you can speak to this point, Adish. But apparently, East Germany has better evidence of an artistic culture than does West Germany today.
I'm not sure about that, but it does seem as though every post-Soviet area has much more visible public art.
Yep.
You have gigantic memorials, gigantic statues and murals all over the place.
Subway stations in Moscow are fascinating.
Of course.
So yes, public or public installations of art is one part, and that is what East Germany seems to be better at. Again, I haven't traveled there personally, so I don't know, but that's what that one article that I posted about shared. But it's not just the art, it's also the language. So apparently, East Germans have had to adopt their language to the way West Germans define the German language. So certain vocabulary-based changes that have emerged in the German language, it's more about East Germans giving up their words and assimilating words used by West Germans.
And was there any example given of this? Or
the one that I remember, and this was surprising to me, the one that I remember comes not from this article, but comes from trying to learn German on Duolingo before I visited Germany. I think the East German words for mother and father used to be different, and now they are the words that are used by West Germans.
Ah.
Yeah, let me just see if I can drag up and no, but I'll link to it. We linked it on the post, but there apparently are differences in terms of simple words for mother and father.
What this reminds me of is a book which I've read in January. This is a book called Because Internet, and it's about how language has changed in the post-internet era.
Mm-hmm.
But as part of this, it lays down background and talks about how in the 19th century, there was an exercise conducted in Germany where a man sent postcards to village school teachers all over Germany and asked them to fill out a questionnaire in which they would say what the local name and the local pronunciation of 40 or 50 different common household objects or phrases was. This book then so this was Germany specifically, but it then talks about how differences in dialect have persisted not just into the 20th century, but even into the 21st, and that there are still regional variations in English across the USA.
Fascinating. Okay.
Just one more thing before we circle back. You yep. mentioned culture, but again, this is the part of the episode where we reveal our ages. But if anyone is listening in who used to watch Doordarshan in the 1980s and early 90s growing up, or who knows, perhaps even when they had grown up, the German programs that Doordarshan used to have at that time were from West Germany rather than East Germany. So public art is one thing, but at least in our corner of the world, West Germany was exporting culture more successfully than East Germany.
And counterpoint to that, I made a visit to Delhi last month, and I took my daughter to see the Dolls Museum in Delhi. But you'd be surprised to see the amount of dolls that museum has from Eastern Germany, from erstwhile East Germany and from Central Europe, but hardly any from Western Europe. If you are in Delhi, and once the lockdown ends, you might want to make a trip to the museum.
I think perhaps this is more about the types of culture that two different nations came up with and were focused on exporting. We may not know what particular culture the West Germans were interested in buying into without either being there or without much more reading.
True. I think it needs to be said, Adisht, unfortunately, we haven't set a new task for psychologists, but we've given much more fodder for sociologists.
I think we can spend another 5 to 10 minutes before we wrap up and try to, and maybe we'll come up with something for psychologists by that time.
Sure.
And maybe not psychologists, but we'll stumble into a completely different field of study. Who knows?
Fingers crossed.
Before we wrap up for the day, you've also linked to something which talks about the impact of German unification on South Korea and why this does not serve as a model for other divided countries. You've mentioned Korea, but of course, even India was a partitioned and divided country.
Yeah.
And though one which has much less interest in reuniting than say Korea would.
The one thing that the question that you just asked reminds me of is a book called Why Nations Fail, written by Acemoglu and Robinson. It's a book worth reading, but the reason I bring up that book and the reason it reminds me, your question reminds me so strongly of that book is because it begins with a town called Nogales, N-O-G-A-L-E-S, in Arizona, I think. Half of the town is in Mexico, the other half of the town is in America. And the authors make the point about how the same town, which because of a historical accident has quite literally been divided between two separate countries, that same town has had so much of a difference in terms of what is available in the shops, in terms of languages that are spoken, in terms of a whole variety of factors. And of course, that same point can and should be applied to North and South Korea. There have been studies conducted about how the average height of the North Koreans is now slightly lower compared to that of the South Koreans, about how linguistic differences have cropped up between North and South Koreans. But as you yourself implied in the question, Adish, it is simply, unfortunately, the case, maybe to a lesser extent in Korea, but also in India, that reunification simply is not likely to be on the cards as it was in Germany. But the one key lesson as an economist that I need to take away from a possible Korean reunification is the economics of it will be much more daunting. Because even if East Germany was, in a sense, slightly worse off compared to West Germany, the differences between North and South Korea are so vast from an economic perspective that reunification simply along economic grounds will be quite challenging.
And we should perhaps mention along with the reunification that there have been multiple partitions in the same time, some peaceful, some quite violent. I'm thinking of Czechoslovakia as well as the former Yugoslavia.
Yeah, and East Timor, I would add that to the list.
South Sudan, if you're counting.
Yes, also South Sudan, absolutely.
You've linked to something which says that reunification is not for the Koreas, but does reunification, in your experience or opinion, provide any models for not combining nations, but simply opening up borders or opening up free trade areas?
The hard-nosed economist in me, or rather the hard-nosed political economist in me, says it's just not feasible. The idealist and the moralist in me says that I would be much happier without any borders in the world at all. I completely agree with Brian Kaplan, who I think has done more than anybody else in terms of popularizing the ideas of open borders. He's in fact got an entire cartoon book out on this particular topic. And I agree with him. The world would be much better if only we could convince everybody of the need to have open borders. Forget free trade areas. I would be much happier with just people being able to move wherever they want in the whole world. But sad to say, we don't live in a world where this idea is going to be anywhere close to being acceptable.
Well, sure, but we can always stick out for the ideal case. But my question was more, if you're moving slowly and incrementally towards that kind of thing with stops along the way, does Germany have any lessons for us if you're on that path?
It helps to have a common culture, common language, and an absence of different religions are the things that come immediately to mind. Unfortunately, that is not the case with quite a few countries that have been divided. Linguistic differences, cultural differences, but most importantly, religious differences are likely to prove an impediment. So in that sense, I think Germany was able to reunite because there were a lot of mitigating circumstances. And I wish this were not so, but in my opinion, I think circumstances are not quite so favorable, whether in India or in Korea or other parts of the world. Whether it's economics or religion, or in certain cases, a mix of the two, I think reunification is a long, long, long way off. Certainly not in my lifetime, probably not in my daughter's either. But I would love to be wrong.
So we'll swing around to this again. Before we close, I just want to swing back to what you mentioned about the wide divergence between the two Koreas.
Yeah.
Before we come back to Germany, and say that it reminded me of the concept of speciation in plant and animal species, and the island hypothesis of how an animal or group of animals that that gets separated from the main population and ends up in either a physical island or something that acts as an island because it's separated by a mountain range or something similar will end up going its own way and possibly evolving into a whole new species altogether. So not that I want to suggest that North Koreans and South Koreans are two completely different species. They're still a long way from that. But it does serve to illustrate this concept from biology.
Yeah, absolutely. So the northeastern corner of South America being linked with the southwestern part of Africa is, I think, one of the most popular examples, if I'm not mistaken.
That's one, but even the Galapagos Island finches,
yes,
which Darwin studied, how he concluded that there would have been a common ancestor, but that just being on islands which were not very differently separated had led to major differences in the shapes of beaks. And this is something which had come up in a book we've talked about earlier on the podcast, Paleo Fantasy by Marlin Zook, though that was more as an explanation than as the entire point of the book.
I am even lesser of an expert in biology than with almost everything else in life, which is not saying much. But I think I read about this for the first time in A Short History of Nearly Everything by Bryson.
One of the most fun introductions to, well, nearly everything.
I'm not going to disagree with that at all. One of my favorite books to read and recommend.
Right. So it's almost time to wrap up. Is there anything more you'd like to say about Germany, or shall we call it a day?
The beer is fantastic. If you ever get the chance to visit Germany, have as much of it as possible. One question that you didn't ask, but I have been endlessly fascinated by myself, is the experience that I had with practically every single train in Germany being late, which to me was the very opposite of what I was expecting, which came as a surprise. I don't know if you have anything to say in this regard.
I have had experiences of going through a German railway strike, which meant that instead of taking a direct train from, I think it was Düsseldorf to Berlin, I ended up having to take a sort of two-train itinerary with a one-hour wait at a midpoint station. And the good part of that one-hour wait was that it gave me time to dash out of the station and have a beer.
Okay. And the final thing, I know we're almost out of time, but I can't help but throw your own question back at you. The same question that you asked me about potential reunification. What do you think would be potential impediments for maybe the Indian subcontinent, maybe Korea, maybe other parts of the world to reunite over time? Are you as pessimistic as I am, or do you have reasons to be more sanguine?
I think the main impediment to reunification of India is that very few people are interested in it. The psychological, and maybe if we finally have something for psychologists now, the psychological dream of reunification comes more from the generation that lived in undivided India and was displaced during partition, which is A, dying out, and B, was not a very large segment of the population. So you do have a number of Punjabi grandparents who still dream of reunification, or at least of the ability to travel freely. Mm-hmm. To some extent, they would have passed that longing down culturally, along with a lot of other baggage. But I don't think anyone in South India or anybody in West India is quite as interested in the idea of being able to travel and move about.
Present company accepted. I think you'd be more than willing to join me on a street food tour of at least Karachi and Islamabad.
While I'd be quite happy to join you on a street food tour, mm-hmm, I think that's accomplished with an easier tourist visa and doesn't really need reunification.
True.
So, which is partly why I was asking you about steps along the way rather than full reunification. But I think this is, again, one of those themes which we will hopefully come back to again and again.
Absolutely.
And we have happily finally come up with, if not a question, at least a theme we can present to psychologists later on, which is, what is the psyche of somebody who wants reunification compared to someone who just wouldn't be bothered?
Target achieved. Excellent.
So, as always, it's been fantastic talking to you. And we are now in lockdown, so we will hopefully be doing this much more over the next 2 weeks.
Absolutely. Look forward to it. More so than usual.
Take care. Goodbye.
All right. You too. Bye.
You've been listening to That Reminds Me, Episode 1H. Today's conversation was between Ashish Kulkarni and Adish Khanna. Ashish's blog is econforeverybody.com and Adisht's blog is adisht.net. That's AADISHT.net.
That Reminds Me is a podcast produced by Ashish Kulkarni and Adish Khanna. You can find all episodes of this podcast at thatreminds.me, where you can leave your comments. You can also email us. Our address is feedback@thatreminds.me. The podcast is supported in part by a grant from Emergent Ventures. The show music is The Carnival of the Animals, performed by the Seattle Youth Symphony, courtesy Muzopen at musopen.org.